Welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series.
A few rules, as always. Please don't smoke in the warehouse, and please remember to silence your cell phones. If you can, refrain from getting up from during the reading. We're only going to have one reader tonight. And up first to introduce Bob Shakoches is Alexa Doran. Please give her a round of applause.
Good evening. So I will read my introduction, but I will tell you that before this, I was worried that I had not had a personal experience with Bob myself, but I met him in line while I was getting a beer, and it was fabulous and exciting, and I feel much more confident about this experience. So thank you, Bob. Okay, to continue to thank you, Bob. I stand before you, immured in a state of awe to be here introducing the legendary essayist, novelist, short story writer, educator, Peace Corps volunteer, culinary aficionado, and journalist, Bob Shakoches.
When did you learn to pronounce my name?
About 60 seconds ago. I'm waving in between, so we'll see. It could be a whole new name. We'll figure it out. Okay. John R. Coates once called Shakoches' work biblical, not in the sense of content, but in the sense of arriving on the page with, quote, forcefulness, unexpected depth, sudden humor, and surprise. As we look across the ever-proliferating landscape of Shakoches' work, spanning from his early work as a journalist, an editor, a war correspondent, for such publications as Harper's, Outside Magazine, and GQ, to his most recent collection, Kingdoms in the Air, Dispatches from the Far Away, which has somehow been clambered under the heading of travel essay, despite the fact that the romping personal selections in this book veritably teem with adventure and insight. Even for that, we barely scratch the surface of the worlds that Shakoches has revealed and continues to reveal. Shakoches is perhaps best known for his Pulitzer-nominated novel, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul, a 715-page masterpiece reminiscent of such canonical authors as Joseph Conrad and Norman Mailer. It is surreal that this National Book Award and Dayton Peace Prize winning book has spurred from a single moment in Haiti. As Shakoches told NPR in an interview, he was approached by a mysterious woman who inquired about his familiarity with voodoo priests. From this flicker of inspiration, we got to the intricately layered, revelatory epic that strides through four generations and countries, in which he reconstructs an entire belief system centered around America's role in the world today, which most certainly should be questioned. To begin to understand the brilliance of Bob Shakoches, a man whose life seems to define the very term ambitious. Shakoches told NPR in an interview, "I consider myself a writer who writes about American expatriates. And if I have any overt cause as a writer, besides writing the best prose I can, it's to try to make Americans have a more visceral feeling about how America impacts everybody in the world." And his ambition feels especially prescient in our cultural moment. In fact, perhaps Coates was right when he labeled Shakoches biblical, since his work has proven to be both historically accurate and prophetic. Ladies and gentlemen, the man whose mark runs deeper than any river, Bob Shakoches. Thank you.
Wow, I'm so glad I met you, Alexis. Gonna hire you for my birthdays. Thank you, beautiful. Thanks for coming. I don't know what your teacher, if you're, you know, students, I don't know what your teacher said to you to get you here tonight. Some awful, grisly, Trumpian threat. But I appreciate it. I really do. I'm surprised because it's the end of the semester. Everybody's tired. And you're supposed to be writing essays right now. I really appreciate you being here. And I want to apologize to anybody who has read this semester and I wasn't there. I just have not been physically able to do what I have done here at FSU for as long as I've been here, which is support the community and come to these readings because it means a lot, especially to the grad student readers. And I wish I could have been here this semester, and I'm not, and thank you for coming here anyways. This is an essay from my latest book, Kingdoms in the Air. It's a collection of 30 years of travel and adventure writing and a little bit of war correspondence thrown in. I just want to read you a quick essay. I want to read it for the women in the room because it will make you smile. The men, it will not make them smile. Trust me on that. But I'll do that, and then I'm going to Bob Butler. My friend Bob Butler asked me to read a little bit from the new novel I'm working on. So I'll do that, and it all should wrap up rather quickly. But this is the title of the essay is Huevos Fritos. Laura, what does huevos fritos mean?
Fried eggs.
Fried eggs, yes. What does huevos mean?
Balls.
Yes, okay. This is a small story, inhumanly cruel, and it ends with a terrible howl. It takes place in a dark forest on the Kamchatka Peninsula in the Russian Far East, a place where parents in St. Petersburg threaten to send children if they misbehave. An inhospitable place known for exploding volcanoes, mosquitoes that swarm like hornets, and most fearsomely, its bears. The story itself contains a cosmonaut, more grizzlies than anywhere else on Earth, a criminally amused wife, and the unimaginable horror that befell its narrator, a hapless, pitiable soul named Poor Me. So let's get it over with. I would take two long trips to Kamchatka to connect with the Russian mafia, who had, in their ever-inspiring entrepreneurial spirit, begun stealing entire rivers, netting runs of wild salmon, shipping tons of illegal caviar back to their associates in Moscow. Anyway, I took my wife along on the first trip, though not the second trip. She was obsessed with catching one of Kamchatka's legendary monster rainbow trouts, something in the 22-pound range, which is a damn big fish. She did it, a bona fide grade 2 worst-case scenario for me, which is why she was forbidden to go along with me on the second trip. Too much bragging, and it's never stopped. She and I and Renat, our local fixer, had an idle day before our expedition launched into the distant wild, so we decided to pile into Renat's pickup truck for a day trip about an hour's ride north of Petropavlovsk, the capital city, to a national park at the base of the Mount Fuji-like volcano that towered above the city. We had read about this park in a government-produced tourist brochure I had been given at the airport. The road ended at a small cluster of clapboard dachas along the banks of a frothing river. The park headquarters, clearly marked on the brochure's map, did not exist, and the park itself, on the far side of the river, was what it always had been, a vast, dense, spruce and birch forest, accessed by a shabby cable and plank footbridge or a shallow crossing for a four-wheel drive vehicle. Across the river, we could see a few mushroom hunters prowling among the trees. "Let's cross over and go for a hike," I suggested, and my wife said, "Sure," and Renat said, "Absolutely not. We will absolutely be eaten by bears," Renat declared, and settled into the truck to await the eventual recovery of our chewed-upon corpses. Because this story also contains a 6-ounce can of pepper spray stuffed into the left front pocket of my jeans, I thought it was not irrational to be respectfully nonchalant about the bears. My wife and I clambered across the rickety bridge and followed a path past a group of picnickers until we came to a primitive road leading deep into the sun-dappled forest. We hiked ahead, alone in the woods, enjoying the pristine solitude, until suddenly a rusty blue Soviet-era van appeared on the track behind us and stopped as it came alongside. The driver, a lean, blonde-haired man, wagged his head at us, frowning, and said something in Russian that had the tone of an admonition. His wife and teenage son nodded their heads gravely, confirming the seriousness of whatever the man was saying. "We don't speak Russian," I said, shrugging, and the man switched to English. "Go back," he said. "What are you doing here? Are you crazy? The bears will absolutely eat you. You cannot walk here without a big gun, huh?" "It's okay," I said. "I have pepper spray." "You have pepper spray," he snorted. "What for? To make bear cry before he absolutely eats you? Turn back now." "Thanks for the advice," I said, waving goodbye as they drove out of sight, shaking their heads in disbelief at our stupidity. 10 minutes later, we came upon them again, parked in a glade off the side of the track, each with a carbine strapped on their shoulders, each carrying a bucket. The family stared at us as if we were the most foolish people they had ever had the misfortune to behold. Again, a lecture from the driver about our recklessness. Then he sighed and said, "Okay, as long as you are here, come with us." They were cutting through the woods, crossing a river, then climbing up a short rise to a meadow where they were going to pick berries. From this place, the driver said, "you have excellent, nice, good view of volcano." I asked him where he learned English, and he revealed he was a cosmonaut on vacation with his family. We followed them through the forest for a few minutes until we came to a raging river spanned by a fallen tree, its wet trunk just wide enough to walk across slowly, carefully, single file. My wife looked at the whitewater rapids below the log and said she wasn't doing it. The cosmonaut said, "Come on! Just up the top of bank, you can see volcano." I said to my wife that I'd be right back. On the opposite shore, I scrambled 15 feet up a bank to a treeless plateau overgrown with brush, so high it was impossible to see anything at all. "Just 10 more minutes," said the cosmonaut, but I knew I couldn't abandon my defenseless wife back on the other side of the river. I thanked the cosmonaut and his family for the hospitality and started back down the steep bank, checking my speed to keep from tumbling into the water. When I took a couple of steps out onto the log, I felt off balance and instinctively crouched to use my hands to steady myself. I have a permanent visual image branded into my memory that accompanies What happened next? My wife waiting for me on the far bank, her quizzical expression turning to wide-eyed, jaw-dropping astonishment as she watched me, poised above the river, rear up from my crouch in a roar, digging frantically into my pants pocket, pulling out an object that resembled a smoke grenade, and hurling it into the rapids. Bending down to gain my balance as I had stepped onto the log, I had triggered the can of pepper spray in my pocket. Its aerosol blast locked into an open position, aimed directly at my crotch. Imagine a tiny jet engine in your boxer shorts. Imagine that engine throttled up to its white-hot afterburn. When I finally stopped howling, my wife had trouble keeping a straight face, eyeing my wincing, bow-legged gait back through the forest. Perhaps something about watching a guy self-immolate his nuts brings out the mirth in women. Yep. I felt like I had just ridden a rhino bare-assed for 30 miles. My wife kept reminding me that the after-scent of pepper spray, once its stinging properties have faded, is a bear attractant, smelling much like an order from Taco Bell. That would be one overcooked burrito with a side of huevos fritos. Thank you. That was for the women. I know they like to hear that story. This is the first chapter of a new novel I'm working on. Its tone and sensibility is exactly the opposite of the essay I just read you. So I'm sorry to whiplash you into a much more darker, mirthless place, but that's what's going to happen here for a little bit. The title of the novel is The Magnificence of Everything That Burns. And it opens in the year 1989 in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And I think that's all the, since it's the first chapter, that's all the background you need. A grave, a writer in London once told Tom Harrington, can be a chatterbox. He stood blank-faced, a yard back in the grass from the dark edge, staring at the dig on the outskirts of the city, the blue overalled men in the pit, their trowels gripped in blue rubber gloves, the white masks wrapped around across their lower faces. An unspeakably grim and mangled chatter, he thought, sniffing at the cool air and its strange zephyrs of mortality, a rot sharp, sweet essence, quickly deflating, released in tiny bursts and then gone, and then another floating up, like an odorous blinking, offending his nose. He tried to parse the dialect, a fouled script of earth and old decay, accentuated by the bright incongruency of colors, a tiny nest of threads of a blouse's embroidery, the patina of cheap jewelry, the valuable pieces stripped from the once new corpses 10 or more years ago, a sampling of buckles and varied buttons, a pair of faded red running shoes, ribbon sandals, the quicksilver wink of eyeglasses, chalky bones exiting the leathery wreaths and strappings of mummified flesh, ivory teeth like the cords of grimy piano keys. The chatter of a mass grave, Tom Harrington thought, expanded according to its residence and seemed to swell from beneath with a ghastly language of low musical notes, something dirge-like played by a sunken orchestra. Or perhaps the throb of a noisy crowd at a boxing match in a subterranean arena, a rumbling under your feet, distant smacks and muted roars, nothing quite Mephistophelian unless hell was just a very sad, tossed together place. Most of all, the chatter produced a contrived wholeness that muzzled the individuality Harrington was determined to help restore and then repackage as a living process, a kinetic abstraction known as justice. There were too many voices here, too many stories, canceling one another out in the marketplace of death. You untangle them for a reason, then fuse them back together for another reason. He had come to see what must be seen if he was to get on with his work. Jorge, the administrator for the team of meticulous forensic anthropologists, stood to Harrington's left, and Miguel Gutierrez from the Ministry of Justice to his right, and a clerk from the Supreme Court to Gutierrez's right. There was the Spaniard, Esteban something, from the working group on enforced or involuntary disappearances. And nearby him was someone from the American Embassy who Tom considered superfluous and irritating. He had intentionally forgotten her name. Behind them and around them in clumps and half circles were men in jeans and windbreakers and neckties or business suits or men in uniform, investigators and agency heads and official onlookers, police and soldiers. And behind them, standing in front of sawhorse barricades, were the relatives of the disappeared. Their huddled stillness so complete, it was easy for Tom to imagine their limbs paralyzed and their tongues cut out. Although given their legendary persistence, nothing could be further from the truth. Today was simply a day that demanded the dignity of silence, pierced only occasionally by a stifled sob. "Let's get it over with," said the faces, each an anonymous portrait of colorless grief. By now the afternoon was waning. Pine boxes of human rubble were being carried to the military ambulances parked on the unpaved lane next to the site, and Miguel Gutierrez asked if it was enough, and Harrington, still weary from yesterday's fly down from New York, said yes, enough, thank you. He would appreciate the chance to shower before dinner. And they walked back to Gutierrez's car and driver, and Tom was taken to his downtown hotel. 2 hours later, Gutierrez was back to collect him, and they were on the road again, a long drive west out of the city, past the National Military College, and into the leafy suburbs to their evening's destination, one of the famous Anglo-Argentinian clubs, looking very much like a page ripped from a Devonshire photo guide, sweeping lawns hosting a cricket pitch and soccer field, tennis courts and golf course, and its national glory, a polo ground. Youth and sport, a prelude to the stateliness of the manor house, the 19th century architecture which centered the compound with Victorian brick and ivy, leaded windows, dormers with striped awnings, and a gabled skyline of clay tiles and exposed chimneys. For Tom, the club and its surrounding underscored the truth that Argentinians weren't really Americans. They were a hodgepodge of displaced Europeans. No mestizos to speak of, no mulattoes. The invaders had annihilated the aboriginal people they might have eventually had the chance to breed with, and the slave ships dumped their loads in Brazil without ever seriously considering a more southern market. If you wanted a black Argentine, Tom thought, look for a Sicilian. The whitest of the whites, of course, were the British and the Germans, each immigrating with their traditions of superiority. Though the Spanish held the founders' claim to power, and the Italians and everybody else flooded the country with peasants and simmering class warfare. The solemn introspection of his earlier ride with Gutierrez from the gravesite had dissipated, and on this drive they had discussed tomorrow's schedules of meetings the Ministry of Justice had arranged for its visiting associate legal officer from the UN's Office of the Administration of Justice. Just an aside here, this takes place in 1989. That was before the International Criminal Court in The Hague was established. So this is the UN's efforts to begin building an international consensus for a global criminal court to try crimes against humanity in The Hague. So that's what Tom is there as, an observer in that, from the sent by the UN. From the UN's Office of the Administration of Justice. Justice, this and that, Tom had said to himself sardonically, listening to Gutierrez, justice everywhere. Hey. Harrington's mission, it was understood, was exploratory, testing the waters for a policy agreement on a protocol. Statutory, constitutional, executive fiat, a protocol that might begin to unlock the previous regime's arrangement with the military dictatorship that had preceded it, the de facto government that had waged war against its own citizens and then stupidly took on Britain in the Falklands, precipitating its own demise. The people could endure tyranny, but not humiliation. Excuse me, the Malvinas, said Gutierrez, correcting Harrington's faux pas, unacceptable to any red-blooded Argentinian. To wriggle itself free of the generals, the state had found it necessary to issue a blanket amnesty for those associated with the crimes of the Guerra Sucia, the dirty war. Enough time had passed and confidence restored for the freshly installed government to begin pulling at the threads of that devil's bargain. Harrington could help, maybe. He came bearing the gifts of legal precedent and international law and resolution, new enlightened mechanisms of accountability that might perhaps one day be grafted onto the stump of Argentinian inertia. The enthusiasm for doing something, Gutierrez said frankly, is complicado. Everybody's favorite word, said Tom. The dinner was meant to clarify something as yet undefined, which made Tom uneasy. Do not mistake our meal for a social invitation, said Gutierrez, and he began to describe the evening's host, Eduardo Bridges, a confidant of the new president, and a confidant of the old president, and a confidant of the dictators as well. Man for all seasons, said Tom Riley, but Gutierrez did not smile. Señor Bridges, an Anglo-Argentine, was a descendant of second son adventurers and merchants and pre-Peron industrialist, himself a banker and a major landowner in the Pampas, a family ranch still inhabited by his octogenarian mother, who sat daily for her afternoon tea in an empty house, in the middle of an emptiness that rolled over the horizon and beyond, nibbling her cucumber sandwiches and pickled tongue. "I have been there," said Gutierrez, opening his door as the driver found a space in the car park. "You would like her. I am not sure you will like her son." Gutierrez, though, had not made any effort to warn Harrington of Eduardo Bridges' anger. He was angry with everybody and did not care to control it, although he allowed his wife to place a cautioning hand on his arm when he got himself too worked up. And then he would sip his wine or cut a bite from his grilled kidney, which to Tom's disgust gave off a whiff of burned piss, before he leaned ahead again into the heat of his grievances, as if Harrington had confronted him, which he had not. Harrington gazed around at the members, the women expensive-looking, wrapped in shawls and appointed with large gemstones, the men ruddy and not slick, but impeccably groomed and tailored in business suits, triangled handkerchiefs poking from top pockets, or blazers and flannels and ascots in team colors, the line collapsing between tradition and pretension. Gentlemen who carried their elitism well without any vain attempt at glamour. It was a Tuesday night, the club's restaurant not half full, the diners and the waiters seemingly habituated by the emotions and topics and rash, impulsive loudness of the aristocratic financier, Eduardo Bridges. "Speak Spanish, Mr. Harrington?" Bridges asked, gruffly standing up to shake his guests' hands as Tom and Gutierrez approached the table where he sat with Senora Bridges, whose plainness had resisted everything she had done, the high fashion, the Beverly Hills hairstyle, the high art of her makeup, her slender neckline plunging into a perfect uplift of bronze skin. Whose plainness had resisted everything she had done to overcome its disappointment. "Spanglish," Tom said, meaning his reply as a self-deprecating joke. "I'm from Miami." And Bridges sputtered, "What in God's name is Spanglish?" Raising his hand dismissively, but it was only to run his fingers front to back through his thinning blonde hair. No warming overture of pleasantries or small talk or charm. They took their seats and studied their menus while the waiter poured from a bottle of Cordoba Malbec. Bridges himself spoke English like an Eton schooled member of the House of Lords, and according to Gutierrez, his native Spanish could be as facile and eloquent as Borges, who Bridges reminded Tom at some point in the evening had a grandmother of British origin. "I want to help you build a context," said Eduardo Bridges, parrying with his knife at the vase of white roses on the table. "I wish to help you inscribe the margins of your project." "I am not against your project, believe me or not. But I doubt very much that you have come here from so far away with a clear understanding of the nature of your project. Yes, you know very well we had a war. What can you tell me about that war?" "Me," I'm saying. "Yes, the war had victims. What can you tell me about those victims? Indeed, Thomas, what can Miguel tell me? Now we can sit together, as you see, but Gutierrez was one of them, not a victim, a subversive, a so-called revolutionary. As he flung out these questions, the heel of his right hand hammered the surface of the table, and his cheeks reddened, and the petals of the roses trembled. Gutierrez, unfazed, concentrated on his loma and fried potatoes. Bridges' wife, her eyes ever more sorrowful, blinded by tears refusing to fall, reached over to dampen the thumping of her husband's hand, and he retreated to his awful kidney to stab at it, grinding a slice between his large teeth, setting down his fork and knife with exaggerated care, drawing a long, steadying breath through his nose before he continued. You want to know if I supported the generals, Thomas? At first, not really. And then, yes, mostly. And then, yes, entirely. And then, no, again, vehemently. Ah, you think whichever way the wind blows, there goes Eduardo Bridges. Things change. Circumstances change. A man must keep his mind clear to follow his principles while he adapts. Is every compromise a moral failing? Perhaps. The trouble was Argentina's, and then it appeared it was not. The world made it its business to interfere. The great powers, their great game here in our little backwater. He looked at Tom pointedly with ice in his pale blue eyes and said, you helped us. Who? The Americans were on our side. And then we weren't, said Tom. Don't be so sure, Mr. Harrington. You said your side. Which side was that? Which side is that? Perhaps that's what you mean. The Germans your country brought to the States after World War II, whose side are they on? You're an intelligent man. Don't bother to answer. Bridges was leading up to something, Harrington felt, setting the stage for a grand lecture, something quite dramatic and punitive to establish his place in Tom's in the pecking order. But unexpectedly, Eduardo lowered his voice to deliver his story in its proper tone. It was the story of his only child, a daughter most beloved. Maria, he whispered harshly to his wife, show Thomas Elena's picture. And out came a photograph from Senora Bridges' leather handbag. A lovely teenager standing next to her towering horse, in riding boots and jodhpurs and dressage coat, donning her hard hat for the photographer as if the camera were a stadium of admirers, swinging loose her wavy blonde hair, her oval face shining and consumed by the bright young fullness of her smile. Harrington looked up from the image to find both Mr. and Mrs. Bridges watching him, a matched set of restrained hostility and frozen agony, awaiting his reaction, as if they might both explode should he dare say a word. He nodded respectfully. The Senora returned the photograph to her handbag, and her husband continued with the story, which took very little time to tell, the way Bridges chose to tell it, his cadence of flagellation, his voice sawing off the facts from the tree of the misery that was his life. She was at university, her second year. She was late for class. I said, my first meeting at the bank isn't until 10. Take my car. The car was in our building's garage, 6 floors below. I did not hear the bomb. I felt the bomb, as I feel the bomb every day. She was 19. She loved to read and ride. She loved music, all kinds. She didn't know what she wanted to be. She was much too unformed for politics. She worried about the students who were being taken by the regime. She never considered she too might be their enemy. Death had come to find Eduardo Bridges, but it found Elena instead and was satisfied. Dirty, clean, what does it matter? It was a war. Her legs were torn off. Her head was on fire. My beautiful daughter. As I held her, she died. There's more than one way to think about what has happened here, Thomas. Harrington offered sincere condolences, but Eduardo Bridges interrupted, shocking Tom speechless by firing his rage point blank at Miguel Gutierrez, his index finger shaking in the air. Why is this shit's sacrifice better than mine? The noise in the dining hall ceased as Eduardo Bridges roared. People glanced over and away with guilty understanding. Poor Eduardo, poor Maria, thank God it wasn't our child. The unfazed observer, Gutierrez, calmly lit a cigarette and turned to Harrington, exhaling smoke with an expression of strained tolerance. This was not my idea, he said, and they left as cognac was brought to the table, with Tom's apologies wedged between the mutual, bottomless hatred of the banker and the former rebel, now a lawyer for the politicians. That's it. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks so much. I appreciate you coming. You know, one of the great pleasures about writing, and I find very few pleasures about writing, is to set a challenge that doesn't quite make sense. And with the last novel, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul, the challenge was to create a female character who the readers are going to hate when they are introduced with her and live with her for a few hundred pages, and they're going to be asking themselves, why am I putting up with this bitch? and then make the readers fall in love with her, totally fall in love with the character. And here, Eduardo Bridges, I'm sure you feel sympathy for his daughter who died in his arms, her face on fire, his beautiful 19-year-old daughter. But Eduardo Bridges might as well have been one of Hitler's henchmen. He's the enemy. His people disappeared, 30,000 kids, college students, high school students, threw them out of airplanes. But here is one of those guys who facilitated and encouraged that, making you almost, you know, tears in your eyes for him. Why is his sacrifice better than mine? And that's a hard question to answer. So anyways, thanks for coming. Thank you.